Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Railroad Commission Votes Against Requiring Production Cuts. Efforts to provide regulatory relief is seen as the better option, by Mella McEwen. After more than a month of debate, hours of testimony, thousands of comments, both verbal and written, the Railroad Commission Tuesday finally put to rest the question of implementing statewide production cuts. By a 2-to-1 vote, the commissioners dismissed the motion by Parsley Energy and Pioneer Natural Resources for a hearing to determine reasonable market demand for oil, which would have led to pro-rationing in the state for the first time in 50 years. Railroad Commissioner Ryan Sitton, who voted against dismissing the motion, said he didn't think the commission addressed the core issue, which was to look at how much of the state's oil production was waste in the face of falling demand. My comments speak to the fact that the primary message in the statute is we have to consider waste. We never really did that, Sitton said. We didn't look at how much waste there was out there, we didn't determine if pro-rationing could prevent waste, and how or examine the mechanism for how to do things from a waste perspective. Commission Chairman Wayne Christian disputed that view, citing the 10.5-hour hearing last month at which the commissioners heard from more than 50 operators, industry associations, and individuals, and thousands of comments and conversations the agency has received since Pioneer and Parsley filed their motion with the commission. I think we honored their request, Christian said. He said he had spent weeks speaking with regulators in other states, including Oklahoma and North Dakota, to see if they would join in cutting production. And I could not confirm any other states would join, which was a prerequisite of the request. I'm glad we did this. This is important, and I think the Railroad Commission did everything possible. Before addressing the pro-rationing question, the commissioners approved two motions, introduced by Christian, designed to provide some regulatory relief to the industry. In one measure, fees will be waived for the remainder of the calendar year for filing forms P-17, W-14, H-1, H-4, and W-3C. The second motion provides an exemption to the statewide Rule 95 to allow operators to store crude in formations other than salt formations for a year, provided they can show crude oil won't escape the formation. Under this motion, the oil must be removed from those formations within 5 years. Commissioner Christy Craddock offered 4 more statewide rules she would like the agency to look at that could provide further regulatory relief to operators. She called for an extension of a deadline to dewater, backfill, and compact authorized pits under statewide Rule 8B4H to expire 1 year from now. Under statewide Rule 13D, Craddock wants an extension to the 180-day limitation on administrative appeals of alternative casing and tubing programs to allow administrative approvals to exceed 180 days. An extension of the 1-year deadline to plug wells under statewide Rule 14B to 2 years would cover wells reporting production in February and subsequently shut in with no reported production from March 1, 2020 to March 1, 2021. With statewide Rule 107B, the Commission's legal staff would be given wider discretion in assessing penalties for violations between March 1, 2020 and March 1, 2021 that didn't involve public health, safety, or environmental impact. This will allow operational flexibility and perhaps give operators a better chance to remain in business, she said. Christian reported on a storage capacity survey conducted by commissioned staff of refineries and common carriers. The 78% of refineries that have responded reported unfilled storage of 18,418,733 barrels, and the 73% of common carriers who have responded reported storage capacity of 52,770,928 barrels. He also applauded the efforts of the Blue Ribbon Task Force for Oil Economic Recovery, which supplied a list of almost four dozen recommendations for the commission to consider to help the industry through the downturn. The focus should be on small operators who produce 1,000 barrels or less a day, he said. Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, speaking on behalf of the task force, told the commissioners, "When possible, relief should be granted to all operators, regardless of size. The economic downturn does not discriminate based on size." He said the members of the task force will continue its work identifying obstacles to the industry's economic recovery, given the extreme conditions facing the industry. This article is entitled, "Ector County, Sheriff, Protest Not About Second Amendment," by J.C. Lewis. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said Tuesday during a press conference that the arrests made at Big Daddy Zane's in West Odessa on Monday night were not related to Second Amendment rights. Members of the group Open Texas were arrested along with the bar owner Gabriel Ellison after the Ector County Sheriff's Office arrival on the scene. The members were arrested being in possession of weapons where they are prohibited. "This entire thing from yesterday has zero to do with the Second Amendment rights of our citizens of this country," Griffiths said. "What it has to do with is calling a group of people from all over the state out here to try to ensure this individual defies the government order." Griffiths said he didn't know about the rally until a member of the media called Monday in reference to a Facebook post about armed individuals in body armor and MASH and possible automatic weapons. He said it was alarming they were coming to West Texas. "We did go to Big Daddy Zane's yesterday. We did arrest the owner for violating the governor's executive order," he said. "We did take into custody seven other individuals." He said the gathering was not a protest, but was a show of force to ensure that this lady could violate the government order. Griffiths said the individual carrying guns weren't holding signs and that the gathering at Big Daddy Zane's wasn't a Second Amendment protest. Earlier in the afternoon, members from the group Open Texas had participated in a rally of support at Anytime Fitness for owner Clint Gillespie. "We didn't go over to the gym yesterday and arrest those individuals for carrying guns on that property," he said. "Those who were arrested were on alcohol licensed premises," he said. Griffiths said they are working on this with the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission and local county attorneys during this time. "We're not here to violate anybody's Second Amendment rights," Griffiths said. "I've been saying it for years, and people will tell you all the good citizens need to arm themselves because all the bad citizens already have. I believe that. Why do you want to use intimidation as a way to keep law enforcement from doing what we're supposed to do?" Griffiths said. Open Texas member and personal trainer Philip Archibald from Plano was not arrested on Monday and attended the press conference Tuesday. He talked to the media afterward. "We wanted to stay safe, so the owner pointed out where we could stand to not be in violation of TABC laws," he said. Archibald has started a GoFundMe to help with bond expenses for those who were arrested on Monday. Of the $100,000 goal, $1,250 had been raised as of Tuesday afternoon. "Officers pulled up on us very aggressively," he said. "Honestly, I am super proud of the guys that I had with me for standing down and remaining calm and like true gentlemen." Griffiths said he didn't think deputies used an excessive show of force Monday. He said they asked people to drop their weapons and they complied. Archibald said they didn't come to seek conflict with the police. He said they were there to empower fellow Americans to be able to get back to work. He said members of Open Texas came to support Ellison and get her some marketing. "The thing is, when your business has been down for so long, it can be hard to get clients to come back," he said. "Honestly, we are a big hit with people, especially the more conservative groups who are all about free speech. That's why she was telling people like we're coming. People love us, like the American people who want to open, come take pictures with us." Ellison showed up outside the sheriff's office Tuesday with supporters. She said the gathering took place on an entirely different property from the bar's property.
Griffiths read the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Code on his phone. He said, "Premises means the grounds and all buildings, vehicles, and appurtenances pertaining to the grounds, including any adjacent premises if they are directly or indirectly under the control of the same person." The TABC could take away Ellison's liquor license, Griffiths said. "When you cause this kind of commotion, we are going to take action," he said. Governor Greg Abbott said that the task force is still working on how bars will reopen. He said they would like to hear from bar owners about strategies they can use. This article is entitled, "City Confirms Ninth Death Related to Coronavirus," from Staff Reports. Midland County Midland Memorial Hospital in the city of Midland on Tuesday confirmed Midland County's ninth COVID-19-related death. The patient, a female in her 60s, died Tuesday at Midland Memorial Hospital. She was a resident at Midland Medical Lodge. No other details will be released at the request of the patient's family. The woman is in the 7th Medical Lodge, is the 7th Medical Lodge resident to die from the virus, according to information provided by the city. Also on Tuesday, the city reported that the Midland Health Department is conducting its investigation on one new confirmed case of COVID-19, bringing the overall case count to 91 in Midland County. The 91st confirmed case is a male in his 80s who was tested by Midland Health. He is a resident at Midland Medical Lodge and is currently an inpatient at Midland Memorial Hospital. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. He is the 37th Medical Lodge resident to be confirmed as having COVID-19. Meanwhile, the health department on Tuesday issued a quarantine of property order for the Medical Lodge, according to Administrator Kerry Powell. This is a standard procedure for the infection challenge at hand. The order does not impose any facility processes or procedures that have not already been in place at the facility, she said in a statement. Our team will continue to work closely with the health department and hospital in this ongoing effort to stop the spread of COVID-19 and protect our community's most high-risk population. As of early Tuesday morning, MMH has done 1,830 tests. 113 were positive, 1,621 were negative, and the results were not back on 96, according to the hospital's website. This article is entitled, "Ector County Reports One New Coronavirus Case, 85 Total," by J.C. Lewis. The Ector County Health Department website reported one new positive case Tuesday, making the total 85. There are three probable cases at this time. ECHD reported that 60 people have recovered. There have been 1,387 tests taken with 1,233 negative results and 69 pending results. ECHD has contacted 1,084 people during contact tracing. The drive-through at the Ector County Coliseum received one positive case. Of the 39 tests done, 27 are negative and 11 are pending. 163 people have called the triage center for testing. Medical Center Health System President and CEO Russell Tippin said MCH has tested 768 with 54 positive cases. MCH is treating four patients at the hospital. Three are on the isolation floor and one is in critical care on a ventilator. They have received 700 negative tests and 14 tests are pending. There aren't any persons under investigation at the hospital during this time. Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Timmons said that one employee has reported a symptom after possible exposure to a housekeeper who had tested positive for coronavirus. The employee with the symptom will be tested. All employees who are possibly exposed have been told to watch for symptoms and check their temperatures. Odessa Regional Medical Center President and CEO Stacy Brown said ORMC has tested 315 with 14 positives. Brown said they have received 296 negative tests with 5 tests pending. ORMC is not treating any coronavirus patients during this time. This article is entitled, "MISD Board President Doesn't Foresee November Bond Election," by Stuart Doreen. MISD Board President Rick Davis stated last month that he doesn't see the district seeking a bond proposal this year. Davis was responding to a question from the Reporter-Telegram about the possibility of a November bond election
Because of the already loaded election calendar in November, it includes the presidential and congressional races and possible races for four of the board's seven seats. Last year, the board failed to pass a $569 million secondary bond election. It failed by 26 votes. It was the first failed bond election in the community in more than 18 years. The streak of winning bond elections had included three for the school district, one for Midland College, one for Midland County Hospital District, and one for the city, and totaled more than $500 million in voter-approved funds. MISD had lost a tax ratification election in October 2016. I believe the board is of the view that we will not be seeking to propose a bond proposal this year, Davis wrote in an email. We are, however, carefully examining processes about how best to move forward to address our continuing facility needs, particularly our capacity, safety, and security, and technology needs of our secondary campuses. It is my hope that we will be able to engage the community in addressing those needs next year. The bond process will be impacted by the retirement of Chief Operations Officer James Riggin. The district announced his retirement on Monday. The Chief Operations Officer is the point person in bond efforts for the district. MISD confirmed this in its posting for a new Chief Operations Officer, noting major responsibilities including providing leadership to effectively and efficiently accomplish the capital improvement plans of the district and to direct the preparation of plans and other requirements for future bond programs. The district lists six other responsibilities for Chief Operations Officer related to the district's bond program. This article is entitled "Elections Office Expects Challenges with Upcoming Election" by Caitlin Randall. Midland County's elections administrator said Tuesday her office is anticipating the coronavirus pandemic will create several challenges with the next election. A runoff election for 142nd District Court Judge will take place on July 14th, according to Elections Administrator Carolyn Graves. Mary Baker and David Rogers were scheduled to face off this month after neither captured more than 50% of the vote in the Republican primary, but the election was delayed over COVID-19 concerns. Graves served as Assistant Elections Administrator for 11 years before she was appointed to her new position 6 weeks ago. She was appointed after the previous elections administrator, Deborah Land, resigned on March 16th, several months after she accepted responsibility for a lost ballot box generating chaos during the Midland ISD bond election in November. Many states have postponed or canceled their primary elections amid the pandemic. State leaders in Wisconsin opted not to postpone the Democratic presidential primary and are now facing lawsuits from voters who say they were disenfranchised. Graves told county commissioners on Tuesday she believes the county should prepare for similar legal challenges. County Attorney Russell Malm also said he expects Midland County could face lawsuits related to the runoff election. While some states have switched exclusively to mail-in elections for the time being, or expanded provisions for those requesting mail-in ballots, Texas has not, Graves said. There has been a lot of speculation out there that if you felt at risk by the COVID-19, you could ask for a ballot by mail, she said. We got a directive from the Department of Justice. That is not the case. She said only residents who are over the age of 65, disabled, or who will be outside the county on election day can request mail-in ballots. The elections office receives no more than 2,500 mail-in ballots in any election, she said. Graves encouraged anyone who does qualify to vote by mail to do so. In addition to potential lawsuits and limited mail-in options, Graves expressed concern there could be a shortage of volunteers to work the election, as most workers fall into the elderly and at-risk categories. We are concerned we might not even have enough workers to have the July 14th runoff election, she said. Graves said she has ordered personal protective equipment for staff, but does not know if it will be delivered before the election. Nationwide shortages have created significant backlogs for entities seeking protective gear. Graves' remarks to commissioners were given during a strategic planning meeting in which county department heads were asked to detail how the coronavirus could affect their departments over the next year.
Increase in child abuse cases. Malm said during the planning meeting that the county has already seen a rise in child abuse cases, and he expects that trend to last as long as the economic downturn does. He said there is an increase in cases involving child protective services anytime the economy is in bad shape. The family court's office may need to hire an additional staff member to assist with the added caseload, he said. Civil cases could create backlog. The postponing of all civil cases could create a backlog when these cases are settled or go to trial, according to Judge David Kobos, Justice of the Peace for Precinct 2. Governor Greg Abbott's order to temporarily halt evictions could also create an influx of civil cases on June 1st, Kobos said, as landlords filed to evict tenants unable to pay their rent because of the pandemic. Property taxes will decline significantly. The economic downturn inevitably will lead to a reduction in property tax revenue for the county, according to County Auditor Veronica Morales. This will not affect revenue for 2021, she said, but the auditor's office is predicting a 40 to 50% drop in property tax revenue for 2022. She said they are also expecting a large decrease in sales tax revenue, but it's unclear by how much. This article is entitled, Ideas Midland Campus Has 300-plus Student Waiting List. Charter School Operator Will Add Extra Kindergarten Class, by Stuart Doreen. IDEA Travis Academy announced Tuesday the addition of another kindergarten class to its Midland campus to meet high community demand. Beginning with the 2020-21 academic year, IDEA Public Schools will partner with Midland MISD to transform Travis Elementary into IDEA Travis. The move was deemed necessary because the Travis campus has one of the longest failing streaks in the state, and the district's other choices were to close the campus or turn it over to the Texas Education Agency. However, local philanthropic groups and businesses worked to bring IDEA Public Schools to Midland. Travis will be the first of at least five of the charter schools in Midland. The others are not scheduled to be partnerships with the district. Initially, IDEA Travis planned to serve 744 children in pre-kindergarten through sixth grade. Demand to attend the school has outpaced the number of spots available. The waitlist for the school has now surpassed 300 children. After IDEA Permian Basin and IDEA Travis's leadership team looked at the waitlist, they decided to open an additional section for kindergarten. I am so thrilled that so many parents want their children to be part of IDEA Travis. We are here to serve our community, and they are telling us that we need to open more spots, Haley McCarthy, executive principal of IDEA Travis, said in an email statement. We can't wait to meet our future families and students. We have spent so much time preparing for them. The next year is going to be great. The additional class will serve another 28 children. Parents who are interested can visit www.ideapublicschools.org/apply to submit their application. This article is entitled, Peyton, People Are Worried, Tired, Frustrated Over Restrictions. Mayor is Happy to See Some Relief in Governor's Latest Order, by Stuart Doreen. Midland Mayor Patrick Peyton described the protests that took place in Odessa on Monday as a symptom of a frustrated community that is beyond ready to take final steps toward normalcy. The protesters at Midland's neighbors to the west resulted in citations, arrests, debates about constitutional rights, and concerns about how much longer certain businesses can exist under restriction during a pandemic. We've got to be careful, Peyton said Tuesday. You can only tell Texans not to do something for so long. Peyton was excited to hear that Governor Greg Abbott has called for salons and barbershops to open on Friday. He wished for an earlier opening date for gyms, which the governor said will be allowed to open May 18th. Peyton said he had been in communication with the task force chair to reconsider restrictions put in place, but didn't have any clue about what the governor might say Tuesday. I am surprised, pleased, and wishing for further action, Peyton said. The governor did not provide a date for when bars might be able to reopen. Peyton said he knows that bar owners are becoming frustrated as everyone else,
and he is concerned people ultimately will not abide by what the governor is asking businesses to do. They are worried, tired, and frustrated, Payton said. Payton said the city will continue to pay attention to what businesses are doing, be empathetic toward their plight, and emphasize that we are not coming after people. He said city and law enforcement officials inside Midland are aware of tension related to being in business and the tension about civil liberties. During a live stream press conference on Tuesday, Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said, "We're not here to violate anybody's Second Amendment rights, but that those involved in the incident outside a West Odessa bar were using intimidation as a way to keep law enforcement from doing what we're supposed to do." Griffiths said he respected those who disagreed with Abbott's order, and if the right plan to open things up came before him, he would even sign such a petition, but he called the show of force a violation. Of the 8 people arrested, 3 were from Odessa. About what was taking place in Odessa, Payton again said Midlanders will remember which businesses were conducting themselves safely. He also said that with the governor's latest announcement, there is more light at the end of the tunnel, and he is hopeful a doorway to a new tomorrow is open quicker than anticipated. Following is a statement from the Midland Chamber of Commerce about the protests that took place in Odessa on Monday. "Unfortunately, there are no easy answers. Some that have chosen to open despite the order believe it is their only option or risk losing their business entirely. Others are acting because they philosophically oppose the governor's decision. Each business must assess the risks associated with their actions. Can they afford the fines, arrest? Also, are they willing to put their customers in a position to be fined or arrested? Will their business survive if they wait another 2 weeks? Ultimately, we encourage businesses to seek every alternative option that will allow them to work within the current legal restraints. Frankly, we all must reassess our business models moving forward. This situation has forced us to adapt, explore new options, and innovate. Midland is known for its wildcatter spirit. We urge businesses to draw on that strength and consider new ways to lawfully offer their services. Can bars partner with restaurants to offer beverages to go? Can gyms offer streaming classes for their members? Our advice is to think beyond how you have always done business in the past and consider how you might do business now and in the future. Then explore these options with the help of professional legal advice." This article is entitled "Midland Development Corporation, Middle Memorial Hospital Recruitment Efforts Lead to 7 More Doctors" by Mella McEwen. Members of the Midland Development Corporation Board of Directors received an update on the 6th year of its partnership with Midland Memorial Hospital to recruit physicians to Midland. Karen Kuhn, Manager of Physician Recruiting for Midland Health, the overall body of the entire Midland County Hospital Taxing District, told board members Monday that 7 physicians would be coming to the Midland-Odessa area. The doctors are a family medicine practitioner, 2 hospitalists, an infectious disease director who began work in January, an orthopedist who will begin in October, an emergency medical doctor who will begin work later this summer, and a pediatrician. Kuhn said that from October 2014 to March 2020, when the MDC-MMH partnership began, the physician retention rate is at 79%. For all that success, Kuhn told the MDC board that challenges remain in physician recruitment effort. "Recruiting practitioners in the neurology field remains a top priority," she said. "That's followed by pulmonary and critical care, where Midland Health is seeking practitioners for inpatient commitments for intensive care unit restructuring and recruiting for outpatient practice. Midland Health is in talks with someone to begin a practice next year. Gastroenterology is another field in which recruitment seems to be difficult," she said. "We have a husband and wife who would like to join us in 2021, but talks happened right before the pandemic, so we couldn't bring them in for an on-site visit. We're going to see if they're still interested and hope to bring them in for an on-site visit," she said. The recruitment efforts do have an economic impact, according to Kuhn. "On average, each physician supports 17 jobs, up from 14, and $1.4 million in wages and benefits on average. Local and state tax revenues are $126,129. The seven physicians recently recruited are supporting 119 jobs, $9.8 million in wages and benefits, $882,903 in state and local taxes, and $16.07 million in per capita economic output of patient care. MDC Board Chairman Wesley Bounds authored a resolution which was unanimously approved to reimburse $199,334.54 for expenses incurred by Midland Health in recruiting the physicians. The resolution was in keeping with MDC's agreement with Midland Memorial to provide up to $450,000 per year in reimbursement of expenses associated with physician recruitment. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, "There's Wisdom in Letting Local Entities End Lockdown," by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. We will be in a fight against the coronavirus for months, if not years, and yet it is time to declare a mission accomplished on one very important goal. The lockdowns of much of the country were undertaken to flatten the curve and largely to prevent hospital systems from being overwhelmed. It was a near-run thing in New York and New Jersey, but the dikes held thanks to the incredible sacrifices of frontline healthcare workers. Now the rhetoric around the shutdowns has shifted, and not very subtly. Flattening the curve and saving the hospitals are out, and not allowing any additional cases to emerge is in. It's difficult to remember, but flattening the curve was never supposed to be about eradicating the disease. A piece by the progressive website Vox featured a widely circulated versioning of the flattening the curve graph and noted that shutdown measures aren't so much about preventing illness, but rather slowing down the rate at which people get sick. A viral Medium piece published in mid-March famously called the period of lockdowns to squelch the disease the hammer, and the subsequent period of living with it the dance. The article didn't deny the seriousness of the disease. If anything, it was alarmist. Yet by the standards of the current debate, the piece was unacceptably lax. The time needed for the hammer, it said, is weeks, not months. After that, it predicted, our lives will go back close to normal. And it contemplated living in a fuzzy realm of trade-offs between important goals, or as it put in, a dance of measures between getting our lives back on track and spreading the disease, one of the economy versus healthcare. Such an acknowledgement of the need to strike a balance between the economy and public health is now considered tantamount to murder. It's become a trope that pro-opening Republicans want to get people killed. A column in the New York Times was headlined, How Republicans Became the Party of Death. A Guardian piece opined, Trump is killing his own supporters. Even White House insiders know it. But the curve has been flattened. As former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Scott Gottlieb notes, the time of doubling cases nationally has increased to 25 days. An analysis by Sean Trend of Real Clear Politics shows most states below their peak cases. There are some states, for instance, Minnesota, Virginia, Delaware, Iowa, and Indiana, that are still around their peaks. But others, like Alaska, Montana, Idaho, Hawaii, Louisiana, Michigan, and Oklahoma, passed their peaks weeks ago. Not too long ago, the Republican who supposedly most wanted to get people killed was Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. In announcing his reopening plan, he recalled all the dire projections of what would befall Florida because he was worried, supposedly late in issuing a stay-at-home order, effective April 3rd. Yet Florida is coming out of this phase of the epidemic vastly better off than Louisiana, Massachusetts, and New York. About 40% of its hospital beds have been available at any given time. In retrospect, there was a wisdom in DeSantis letting communities and counties take the initiative in a big, diverse state. Besides which, people are capable of making their own decisions. They decided to stay at home before the state formally told them to. According to a Wall Street Journal report, the movements of people began declining in mid-March, well before the statewide stay-at-home order. The reverse is also true. If they are still afraid of the virus, people aren't going to return to normal whether their states are formally open or not. In a better world, the lockdowns wouldn't merely have avoided the worst, but crushed the spread of the disease. That hasn't happened. We will be engaged in a dance for some time, even if one faction in our national life only ever wants to wield a hammer. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled Assumptions About Coronavirus Are Key to Nations' Policies by Ben Shapiro, Creator Syndicate. As Americans debate how to reopen our society in the wake of coronavirus, we seem to be breaking down into three groups. First, those who believe the virus isn't particularly serious and desperately want to reopen everything as soon as possible, a small minority of Americans by polling data. Second, those who believe the virus is extraordinarily serious and want everything to remain closed as long as possible, a significant minority of Americans. And third, those who believe the virus is extraordinarily serious, that the economic damage brought about by COVID-19 is extraordinarily serious, and that we will have to reopen in considered fashion. The vast majority of Americans. While politicians on either side of the debate hope to position their opponents as advocates of either Group 1 or Group 2, the reality is that the honest debate is happening within Group 3. So what does a considered coronavirus reopening strategy look like? That question rests on a deeper question. What assumptions are we making? Obviously, we all want to reduce deaths to the lowest possible number. But what assumptions are baked into our policy recommendations? Are we assuming a vaccine will come along in 3, 6, 12, or 18 months? Are we assuming herd immunity conferred at 60% of the population? Or 80%? Are we assuming therapeutic measures that would reduce the infection fatality rates by 20, 30, or 100%? And within what period of time? We also want to reduce economic harm to the lowest possible level. Again, we must ask what assumptions are baked into our policy recommendations. Are we assuming that a 75% reduction in restaurant seating will save 50% of restaurants? Are we assuming that shoppers will continue to socially distance 6 months from now? Are we assuming that the government will be able to shoulder trillions more in debt despite an underlying decrease in international appetite for such debt? The question of assumptions is key to our policy making. That's because if we assume the worst, no therapeutics that seriously knock down the infection fatality rate, no vaccines for 18 months or more, and an economy that simply cannot function at one quarter or even half of normal capacity, then we are forced to a simple conclusion. In the absence of any significant change to the status quo, we must pursue a strategy, a so-called controlled avalanche. That strategy has been coined by Israeli scientists, who suggest that the best strategy for reducing deaths while achieving herd immunity would be to trench populations and then expose the least vulnerable populations to COVID-19 in order to let them develop antibodies. In essence, performing with the public health the same function ski resorts perform when they create small avalanches in order to avoid a major avalanche. The simple fact is that 40 to 50% at low estimate of all deaths in the European Union from COVID-19 have occurred at nursing homes. The same is true in California. Had the authorities properly protected nursing homes, the infection fatality rate across the industrialized world could be half of the current rate. It is also true that the infection fatality rate for COVID-19 ranges widely by age. As of late April, of the 37,308 deaths recorded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, just 1,036 were people under the age of 45, and just 51 were below the age of 25. Even among younger populations, the vast majority of deaths were people with underlying complications. Israeli scientists suggest that protecting the elderly and the vulnerable and then allowing herd immunity to develop among the least vulnerable would radically reduce overall mortality by more than 40%, reduce the maximum number of people in need for ICUs by more than 60%,
and decreased the time required to allow freedom to low-risk populations for months. This is obviously not a foolproof strategy. There is no foolproof strategy, but it may be a better strategy than simply hoping for the best while watching the world economy implode, even as we know that our deepest hopes for a deus ex machina may go unrewarded.
This is the obituary column for Wednesday, May 6, 2020. Betty Sue Houston Rose. Betty Sue Houston Rose, 74, of Midland, Texas, ran into the loving arms of her Lord and Savior May 1st, 2020, surrounded by her family, after her body lost its battle to lengthy illnesses. She was born in Silver City, New Mexico on November 10, 1945, to the late Chuck and Mary Louise Billy Houston. They moved to Midland, Texas. She was baptized by Brother Wood at Calvary Baptist Church at the age of 8. She graduated from Midland High School in 1963. She was preceded in death by her parents, Chuck and Mary Louise Billy Houston. Survivors include her sister, Johnny Rolwitz, and husband Carl of Andrews, Texas, her four children, Will Rose and wife Shelby of Midland, Texas, Sheila Scott of San Angelo, Texas, and husband Ross Scott of Bagata, Texas, Melinda Rose Jackson and husband Gregory of Weatherford, Texas, Mary Weddle and her husband Joe of Midland, Texas, her lifelong friend Ann Wimberly of Midland, Texas. She is also survived by 9 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren and many nieces and nephews, and can't forget her 2 cats and her dog, Faith. The family wishes to thank Interim Hospice and those who extended your love and support for Betty during her final days. A family visitation will be held Wednesday, May 6, 2020, from 7 to 9 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. A service celebrating her life will be held on Thursday, May 7th, at 2 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel, followed by a graveside at 3 p.m. held at Rest Haven Memorial Park and Cemetery, 4616 North Big Spring Street. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Brian Hobbs. Brian Hobbs, age 54, passed away April 28, 2020. He was born February 16, 1966, to Jerry F. Hobbs and Carla S. Hobbs of Midland, Texas. Brian is survived by his mother, Carla S. Hobbs, sister, Tricia Hobbs, and brother, Joel Hobbs, Jennifer, his niece and nephew, as well as numerous aunts, uncles, cousins, and extended family. He is preceded in death by his father, Jerry F. Hobbs. In fulfilling Brian's wishes, the family has chosen cremation services. Funeral arrangements were entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Tomina Ann Clark. Tomina Ann Clark, 76, an independently strong woman and proud mother and grandmother, passed away peacefully under the kind care of Sherman House, Hospice of the Valley, on April 16, 2020, in Scottsdale, Arizona. She was born in 1943 to Thomas Jacob and Catherine Lucille Renard at Harris Methodist Hospital in Fort Worth, Texas. Graduated in 1961 from Pascal High School in Fort Worth. She married David W. Clark on December 22, 1961 in Dallas, Texas. The following year, they welcomed a son, David Jr. As time marched on and they drifted apart, the marriage ended in 1988. Survived by son David, daughter-in-law Stephanie, and 2 dearly loved grandsons, Spencer and Gannon. Also survived by her brother Tom, sister-in-law Bonnie, numerous nieces and nephews, and a host of cousins. Welcomed into heaven by parents Thomas J. and Lucille Renard, and stepfather Clyde Gwynn, paternal grandparents Robert and Grace Renard, and maternal grandparents James Stroud and Susie Stroud. A private service for immediate family will be held at a later date. Brenda Kendrick. Brenda Kendrick, 70, of Midland, Texas, passed away on Sunday, May 3, 2020. Family will have a private viewing on Thursday, May 7th, and a private funeral service on Friday, May 8th, at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. She is survived by her husband, John L. Kendrick, his son, Justin Kendrick, stepsons, John Kendrick Jr., Craig Kendrick and Jeff Kendrick, daughters Erica Wiggins,
and Courtney Flowers. Stepdaughters Eureka Keith and Tiffany Kendrick Nicolos. One sister, one brother, 20 grandchildren, and 45 great-grandchildren.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. Section A. Sheriff says it's the law of the land. Griffiths says protesters violated TABC code by Michael Merlo. Armed organizers of a Monday rally to help a local bar owner reopen despite the governor's order remain at odds with local law enforcement, who called the event a show of force and not a protest. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths, during a Tuesday news conference, said that the arrests made at Big Daddy Zane's in West Odessa Monday were of the bar owner for violating Governor Greg Abbott's executive order and of protesters carrying weapons on property where alcohol is sold. Griffiths said six were charged with felonies related to unlawfully carrying a weapon on a licensed premise, one for interfering with the duties of a police officer, and the owner for violating the governor's orders. After the news conference, Gabrielle Ellison, 47, stood in the Ector County Sheriff's Office parking lot with a few of her employees holding protest signs. She said bringing a SWAT team was overforced and that the armed protesters were on her private property, different from the bar. It's separated, she said. Different taxes, different everything. Ellison told armed protesters to stand behind her bar's property and on her private property. She has said she is going broke because her bar has been shut down during the COVID-19 crisis, and she is worried about her employees. She and others took issue with game rooms being allowed to open at 25%, but not bars. The Monday protest had about 20 people with assistance from Open Texas, a group that has traveled around the state with weapons, trying to help businesses that the governor deemed non-essential reopen their doors in what Open Texas members say is a peaceful way. Griffiths said that he doesn't agree with everything that Governor Abbott does, but that his order is the law of the land. I'm ready for everybody to get back to work, he said, and this entire thing from yesterday has zero to do with the Second Amendment rights of our citizens in this country. He said that if the governor told him to seize everyone's guns, then I'd tell him to go jump out over a cliff. It ain't gonna happen. We're not gonna take good citizens' guns from them. He said that Open Texas was not protesting for their rights, but it was a show of force to ensure this lady could violate the governor's orders. They weren't holding signs and protesting. This was not a Second Amendment protest at all. He added that this is an issue with carrying firearms and trying to intimidate people and provoke a response. He said that the armed protesters were on an alcohol-licensed premise and that he wasn't trying to violate anybody's Second Amendment rights. If you don't like what our governor's doing, vote for somebody else for governor. That's all I can tell you. He has put forth what he believes is the best for our state, for our citizens. He is our duly elected governor, and that's what we're going to follow. This is not the way to do this, he said, bringing a bunch of people from other parts of the state in here to try to meet your goal. There's a better way to do this. Let's do it together, he said, adding that he would sign his name to a good, prudent document to send to the governor to get Ector County citizens back to work. Griffiths said that the Ector County Sheriff's Office has more work to do on the incident and that more updates would come later. The arrested protesters, he said, were violating the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission code. The premises is any property controlled by that person. All that property out there belongs to that lady, he said. Along with media during the press conference was Open Texas member Philip Archibald, 29, who was not arrested during Monday's protest because he was not armed. Archibald questioned Griffiths about the TABC code, saying, "What about Penal Code 46.035 that states that premises is the building and not the surrounding property, parking lots, or anything else?" In response, Griffiths read the TABC code, saying that the premises are the grounds and all buildings, vehicles, and appurtenances pertaining to the grounds, including any adjacent premises, if they are directly or indirectly under control of the same person. In an interview after the press conference, Archibald said that he pretty much runs the public relations for Open Texas and that he talks with business owners and makes sure that my guys are on board with our mission to do everything peacefully and really empower business owners to stand up for their First Amendment rights. Archibald said, "I am working with some constitutional lawyers. We got some big names behind us, and we're going to fight this. We're going to fight it the way regular people fight it, in the court, because that's where political battles are won." He added that he thought all of the other members are still in the jail and he is working on getting them out. He said that they will continue to protest for other businesses trying to open when the other members are out. "We are not breaking laws. We are making sure that we are 100% within the laws. That's why we did not get arrested in Dallas, didn't get arrested in Houston or anywhere else. But we are going to continue helping businesses open up, regardless of whether or not that's against the governor's executive order, because that order is unconstitutional." Ellison said she is not yet getting help from lawyers from Open Texas, but had the opportunity to speak with her own. She went to jail Monday and was released later that day on a $500 bond. She said she would open the bar again, but with an attorney present. "I believe that the guys were showing their Second Amendment to protect my First Amendment," she said, "and that the Ector County Sheriff's Department stepped all over that Second Amendment. Excessive force used our tax dollars. They stepped all over the Second Amendment," she said. Those arrested for felonies of unlawful carrying of weapons were detailed in a press release by the Ector County Sheriff's Department as Wyatt Wynn, 23, of Frisco, Jesse Semrad, 36, of Tyler, Carol O'Brien, 19, of Amarillo, Joshua Watt, 31, of Odessa, Anthony Elder, 24, of Mansfield, and Braden Burnery, 21, of Midlothian. As of Tuesday, the press release details all are still in custody. Trinity Jackson, 31, was charged with interference with public duty and released on a $500 bond Tuesday.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing to read from the front page of the Odessa American. Salons and Barbershops to Open Friday, by Michael Merlow. Help is on the way for those who need a haircut. During Tuesday's hospital briefing, Mayor David Turner said that one of the changes to the governor's order is that salons and barbershops can open Friday with social distancing restrictions. Governor Greg Abbott also said during his news conference that on May 18th, gyms and fitness centers can reopen at 25% capacity. County Commissioner Eddie Shelton reported that out of 1,387 tests, Ector County has had 85 positive cases, 1,233 negative cases, 69 pending, 60 are recovered, and there have been 4 deaths. At the drive-through testing, Shelton said they have received 163 calls for screening and tested 39 in total. 27 tests came back negative, 1 has been positive, and 11 are pending. Shelton said there were 13 people tested at the drive-through on Tuesday. He added that the National Guard tested around 84 people on Saturday and that the results have not been received at this time, he said. He said that people who feel they need to be tested can call the drive-thru number for screening at 432-703-5481. Medical Center Hospital President and CEO Russell Tiffin reported that as of out of 768 tests, 54 have been positive, 4 of those are in the hospital, and 1 is on a ventilator. He said that 700 tests have come back negative, with 14 tests pending. MCH Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Timmons said that no patient interaction had occurred with the MCH housekeeper who tested positive for the virus because they cleaned the rooms after people left them. Timmons said that they are watching 35 people potentially exposed. Those are just other staff, people that ride to work with this individual. They have eaten lunch with them, those types of things. She said that MCH will be testing one of those people who reported having a symptom. She also stressed that people coming into the building should wear a mask or to wear as MCH opens 14 days symptom-free and want to donate plasma, then they can call 432-640-2607. Odessa Regional Medical Center President Stacy Brown said that out of 315 tests, 14 have been positive, 296 have been negative, and 5 are pending. She said that no patients are in the hospital. The City of Odessa Public Information Officer, Devin Sanchez, reported that the Fire Marshal's Division and the Odessa Police Department have cited 10 different businesses in total for COVID-19-related incidents. ORMC Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Rohit Saranvan, referenced people protesting during the pandemic in his daily update and said that going out there and getting the disease is not considered protest. We understand that you have an opinion and you want your opinion to be heard, but remember, going out there, getting yourself sick or getting someone else sick is not the definition of a protest. Keep that in mind even if you are out and you need to be heard. Be careful not to get other people sick, and be careful to not get yourself sick as well. We will have to take care of you either way, he said. He also said that those with COVID-19 become more vulnerable to other infections if they are sick and could risk co-infections with other illnesses such as strep throat or the flu. He referenced a website at https://tinyurl.com/YBTENGDM, which has a self-checker that helps people walk through their symptoms. He said that the website also gives information on the different tests, including the PCR, which is the swab test, and the antibody test, which identifies if people have been exposed to the virus in the past. There is also a list of testing sites on the website. We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.